This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3939, for Thursday, the 7th of September, 2023. Today's show is entitled, How I Got Into Tech and Hacking. It is part of the series How I Got Into Tech. It is hosted by Trickster and is about 21 minutes long. It carries a clean flag. The summary is, getting interested in tech can start in both odd and familiar places. This is Trickster's story.
Hey everyone, this is Trickster. If the name rings a bell, you might know me as the co-founder of MobyGames.com. I'm also a demo scene coder for many, many years. I have a few first place productions under my belt. And these days, I'm the showrunner of a yearly vintage computing festival. As a hacktivist, I was also involved in the birth of the abandonware movement in 1997, and I'm also one of the curators of a DOS game archival effort that has been going on for slightly over 25 years. While I don't use the term to describe myself, I do consider myself a hacker. And I thought, since Hacker Public Radio is running a little low on shows, it might be time to record an emergency episode following the most common topic that people pick, how I got into tech. I got into tech via intellectual curiosity and also the need to control my environment a little bit. I was an unabashed nerd as a kid, and unfortunately, all throughout middle school, I was bullied and, in many cases, beaten weekly. So these two impulses, needing to control my environment because of that, and just simply being curious, naturally led to hacking. So I'm going to go ahead and describe my timeline in those terms, because how I got into tech and how I got into hacking, to me, are synonymous. So let's go all the way back to 1977. Little Trickster is 6 years old, and his father is working for Teletype Corporation, which used to make machines that would sit on either end of a phone line and someone would type on one end and it would output be typewritten on the other end. Obviously, these machines are gone, having been supplemented by everything from, you know, fax to the internet. But at the time, in 1977, it was necessary to analyze serial lines, and so my father brought home a serial line analyzer. And it's my very first memory of sitting in front of anything with a display and a keyboard. You would connect serial to both ends and set the baud rate and what have you, and then you would be able to inspect the traffic going back and forth, but you could also inject traffic. So you would type on the keyboard, and it would show up on this tiny one-line vacuum fluorescent display. And I suppose that's where it all began, really. Go forward two more years to 1977, and now I am in second grade and looking at an Apple II. But at the time, I'm too interested in arcade games and console gaming with the Atari 2600 to notice, really, that the Apple II was not just an educational instrument. It was actually a computer running software. But that changed a year later in 1980. When a neighbor's mother, who used to work for AT&T, brought home an Osborne, which is a portable, or really luggable, computer that runs CPM and has 2 5-and-a-quarter-inch floppy drives. And one of the diskettes that she brought home, and I'm not even sure she knew she brought it home, was Colossal Cave Adventure. My friend and I would, I don't know how, but we figured out how to start it up, and we spent hours trying to solve Colossal Cave Adventure, just exploring everything and typing all the verbs we could think of, naughty and nice. And that was pretty much it. That sowed the seed for, hey, this is an instrument, this is a machine that does what I tell it. And I've never really shaken that off. Let's go forward three more years and end up in 1983. I'm at a friend's house. They have an IBM PCXT, and that friend, actually the friend of a friend, their father worked for AT&T and as such had free long distance. Back in the 80s and some of the 90s, long distance cost extra money for those too young to remember. You would pay something like 10 or 15 cents a minute. If you called overseas, it was dollars per minute. Thankfully, we don't have that problem anymore. But when you had free phone calls and a computer and a modem, You could imagine that hilarity would ensue. We would connect to CompuServe, but we wouldn't do it to download files because we weren't quite aware of that yet. We would join these online games where lots of real people could all participate in the same game. Think like a trivia game or something like that. And we joined them not because we wanted to play the games, but because we wanted to just simply hang out in the game lobbies and talk to people. And it was astonishing that there were people from all across the continental United States all typing to each other. It was fascinating. Also in 1983, I was fortunate enough to go to a middle school that had really good funding. They had a lab of Apple II Pluses, and I discovered AppleWriter. And AppleWriter let me type up my messy papers instead of handwriting them and, you know, constantly erasing and so on. I would get half a letter grade more improvement than my classmates simply because I would hand in typewritten things. Not typewritten, of course, they would be printed out in a dot matrix printer, but you get the idea. And of course, I love the idea that the computer could help me fix my mistakes before I exposed them to others. I really wanted a computer at that point, but unfortunately, we could not afford one. But my father was very forward-thinking, and instead of purchasing a computer, he bought a computer magazine subscription. Ours was Family Computing. So every month, a computer magazine would arrive, and I would just consume it cover to cover. And it wasn't as good as having a computer, but it definitely prepared me because this magazine, like all 80s computer magazines, had it all. It had coverage of the 8-bit micros, the newly emerging 16-bit systems. It had basic programs you could type in, and it even had those basic programs with slight modifications for other systems. So the base program was AppleSoft Basic, but then here's the section to change for the PC, and it would be like 10 lines you would change, and here's the section for Commodore, and so on. And reading that kind of taught me a little bit of computer programming without actually having the computer. In 1984, my middle school was teaching languages to seventh graders. And I was taught BASIC, and I was also taught Logo. For those who don't know, Logo is a graphical programming language where you enter simple commands like put the pen down on the paper, move forward 10 pixels, turn right 90 degrees, move forward another 10 pixels, and so on. You could draw simple pictures with it. It was designed as a teaching language, but that is where the light bulb went on with programming for me. Not necessarily BASIC. I don't know why. But in Logo, you could define procedures. These procedures could take arguments, and you could name the procedures whatever you wanted. So this light bulb of, oh, if I'm doing a lot of repetitive actions, and the only thing that changes about them is this one thing, which is, of course, a variable, then I can kind of put it all in, you know, a macro. It wasn't a macro, but you know what I mean. It's you could bundle it all up in a little package and give it its own name. And all you had to do was change the argument, and then all the code would run with that different argument. Light bulb completely went on. I really loved programming. At that point, I was excelling in the two programming classes that I was in. And myself and a few other students were similarly gifted, and the school was forward-thinking enough that they created a special seventh grade class just for gifted computer students. This was amazing. Think of it like a Montessori class almost. It was not directed. Now, unfortunately, that means, of course, we ended up playing and copying a lot of games in there. But they arranged to have presentations from local computer people come in. I grew up in the Chicagoland area, and Gottlieb was there. Gottlieb was an arcade game manufacturer. They created Qbert. They created the Laserdisc game Mach 3. And someone from Gottlieb dragged those arcade games in for one of our classes and gave us an overview and a demonstration of the arcade games and how they were created. Satisfying and yet expanding my intellectual curiosity. Finally, in Christmas of 1984, we finally did receive a system. My father worked for AT&T at the time, and he got a corporate discount on their clone, their PC clone at the time, the AT&T 6300. And finally, we had a computer, and the first thing I did, I went bonkers entering in all of the magazine type-ins from the Family Computing magazine subscription we had previously. And typing them in just indirectly teaches you programming, teaches you better programming, teaches you structured programming. Moving on a little bit more into high school, that's pretty much where intellectual curiosity went rampant. I was also interested in music, and I was trying to get better music out of the computer we owned. But an IBM PC doesn't have a sound chip, so you figured out how to work within your limitations. I started out writing basic programs that would play music. I then figured out chords by playing arpeggios fast. It's a single output PC speaker. It can only play one note at a time. But, you know, if you can quickly, rapidly, you know, rotate through different notes, it sounds a little bit like a chord. Later, I saved up and purchased a music construction set for the PC, which sounded very much like you were trying to murder a buzzer. But it did try to approximate four voices, and that was fantastic. And later, I got Bank Street Music Writer, which came with a piece of hardware that output six real voices. And that further fueled my passion for trying to compose and play back music on the PC. Obviously, being a teenager during this time, I was copying more and more games. But I was a little different than my friends. I wasn't copying games based on how fun they were. I was copying games based on how well they were programmed. I tended to grab the simulators, the flight simulators, or maybe a racing game or something that had particularly fast graphics, that kind of thing. Certainly arcade games, arcade ports. Not all of them were terrible for the PC. Unfortunately for me, in high school, I was not particularly good at math. Maybe I was, but I wasn't a particularly good student. And as such, I did not qualify for the AP programming classes, where they were teaching all sorts of fun stuff, like advanced algorithms, and they were using this new language I'd never heard of, Pascal. I ended up ditching one of my classes to audit the programming class. It was probably social studies or history, something that, of course, fascinates me now, but didn't in high school. No idea why. Funny how life works out. But I really wanted to learn Turbo Pascal because it ran so much faster than BASIC once it was compiled. And a lot of my friends were in there, including Brian Hurt, who I later co-founded Moby Games with. When I wasn't trying to figure out how to hack my classes at school, I was back at home trying to figure out how to hack the hardware. Our computer did not have a hard drive, so trying to deal with a single floppy and then later two floppy system required a little bit of hacking, especially if you wanted to play games that required two floppies or a hard drive or so on. One trick I learned was whenever a program exits, it has to reload command.com. This is a PC running DOS. But there were situations where I couldn't have the DOS disk in the drive, so I learned how to create a RAM drive, copy command.com to it, and then set the comspec environment variable to point to the RAM drive, and that saved quite a bit of disk swapping. Also, little things like figuring out that burning up another 36 kilobytes of RAM was worth loading a small disk cache just to get the forced read-ahead caching. So some disk caches, you know, you tell them to read one sector, and then they'll go ahead and read all the sectors on that track anyway, just in case you need the next one, the next sector. And a very small cache could go ahead and do that. And that made slow games load from floppy disk, three times faster probably. My journey in tech continued throughout high school, pirating games, joining pirate groups, working for software stores and becoming a courier because I could grab the games from the software stores, copy them, throw them up onto a BBS, and return the game the next day. Let's jump forward to New Year's Eve 1990. I've already told you that I was kind of trying to force non-musical computers to do better music, and I delighted in well-programmed games versus like adventures and stuff. I loved pirating games, so it's no wonder that when I discovered the demo scene, I really took to it. I had been aware of the demo scene indirectly by watching Cracktros and other animated messages that show up before you play a game, showing, you know, who cracked it, shout-outs to their friends, bragging, that kind of stuff. But I grabbed my first real pure demo, the Space Pigs Mega Demo, off of a BBS on New Year's Eve 1990, and I watched it, and just everything clicked. It was like, there's a group of people out there who hack the computer for fun, make it do stuff that the designers never intended. And that was it. That's all I wanted to do. And ever since that time period, I have been involved in the demo scene off and on in one way or another. Let's continue on. Throughout the 90s, my hacking journey continues. My first Unix was Harris UX on a Harris mini computer at DePaul University. Then later, I was working for a Unix company. I worked for Mark Williams Company. This is before Linux existed. Mark Williams Company created a homebrew clone of System 5R4 called Coherent. And it was, actually, it wasn't even System 5R4. It was before that. It was really like a clone of System 7. So it was kind of limited. But it was a Unix that you could run on a 286 or higher. And it cost $99 and came with a huge, gigantic manual. And working for them, first as technical sales and then later in the technical support department, of course, I learned all sorts of fun hacking. My very first email address that delivered email directly to my house was hacked up via UUCP. In fact, you can search and try to find my original email address, which is, get ready for this, mwcbangutrix bang mwcbbs bang trxhome bang trixter at uunet.uu.net. That was a real email, and it got all the way to my house. Later, I left Mark Williams Company and no longer ran Coherent on my home system, although there was another good reason for that, but that's a story for another day. So I ended up running Slackware on my 386 40 megahertz system in 1994, connecting to the internet via SLIP, serial line IP. This is before PPP existed. Discovering this crazy new thing called the World Wide Web. Hacking knowledge continued by finding out that you could, by discovering that you could view the source of any web page you were looking at. So that's how I taught myself HTML. Also around this time, I was doing some demo scene coding. I preferred Pascal, having learned it from that AP course I was crashing. But the thing that made it usable for demo coding and for anything performance related is that at some point, Turbo Pascal, I think it was 6 and later, added the ability to have inline assembler. And that was fantastic. You could just simply inline assembler to replace a series of statements that were very slow or that the compiler couldn't optimize. Then something curious happened. In the late 90s, I had children. I was married in 94, and we had children in 97 and 99. And as a default activity, hacking mostly stopped. I'm not mad. This is nobody's fault. It's just life. And I thought at the time that, well, this is the next phase of my life. I have children now. I have a family. I need to pay attention to them, and I need to provide for them. What ended up happening is that all that prior hacking experience I just described, all those skills ended up translating into good job skills and job performance. I became skilled at troubleshooting poorly documented systems and removing bottlenecks. I worked for a cybersecurity firm for 5 years, troubleshooting crazy stuff like quadruply natted firewalls. And I was called the smartest kid in the room for most of the 2000s. These days, I am not called the smartest kid in the room, and most of the time I'm not, and that's actually good because that means everyone is smarter than me, which means I must be in a really great work environment. Hacking does continue, but only sparsely and really on my terms. For example, I was always annoyed that the original PC could have been programmed better. So eventually, my demo scene activity focused on it. I've had a crew, so to speak, since, let's say, 2013, and my crew and I won the old school compos at Revision 2015 and Evoke 2022, and we received Scene.org awards and Meteoric awards for those productions. Those awards are kind of like the Oscars for the demo scene, just for lack of a better term. So I still hack. It's just changed in scope. You know, here's another scope change. As previously mentioned, I help run a vintage computer festival every year, Vintage Computer Festival Midwest, and we have to put on a show that serves over 2,000 people with only 6 volunteers and hardly any money or equipment. We also don't charge for the show, so we kind of have to make do with donations and donated equipment and spur of the moment grabbing somebody for manpower and things like that. Trying to put on a vintage computer festival that serves over 2,000 people with only six guys has to be hacking in some form. It's just got to be. You know, hacking has served me really well for half a century. I guess I'm happy to be that old, but I guess I'm also happy that hacking has enriched my life for that long. You know, hacking isn't limited to just personal enjoyment of tech. It's helped me in my career, and it's also helped me socially. When you meet another hacker, you've both immediately got this shared vocabulary and interests, and you can use that to speak in a sort of shorthand to communicate quicker and more effectively. When I go to a demo party, you know, I like to say that I can crack a Shade Bob joke and someone somewhere will get it. And that's a really great feeling. That has been my journey thus far. I hope it continues. And I hope that if you are a budding young hacker and you are trying to hack your life, your situation, your tools, your utilities, your relationships for better, I hope you have the intellectual curiosity to discover what works for you and carry it through. Thanks for listening.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HPR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.